But if you get over there, go down to the bottom. No, that's the tax acts. Go back to the front page. And at the front page, I say there's problems. Keep flipping back. Ah, okay, go down to problems. See down there at the, yeah, problems. Okay, now scams. Hit scams. And here, I've got decades of experience in this movement, and there's been a lot of con men that float through this movement, like Ken Hunter. And, I know that Sean knows about Ken Hunter, but, these are a lot of people I've run across in the movement over the last couple of decades that, have been out hawking various legal arguments, and it got a lot of people in trouble. But go on down to Judge Anna, Joe. It's down toward the bottom. David Wynn Miller. Wow, he's a crazy guy. I mean, real crazy. It's wrong thing, Joe. Go back. Oh, that's correct. That's okay. That's Judge Anna. Now go to the very bottom of this page. Now I address, fake Judge Anna. She claims she does research, but she doesn't. She just makes things up. Now here you got, since she was promoting U.S. National, I thought I would address her argument about U.S. National on the page that I've got devoted to her on that website, Fake Judge Anna. Now go up a few lines, Joe, to the spot where it tells you what the segment addresses. But all of these, I provide links to these pages out of the statutes at large. Like you can hit on 28 stat 53 or 38 stat, nationals. Okay. So this is where I deal with the popular argument about a national. So going down to the links to the statutes at large. So you can see my explanation here about what nationals are. And too many people will make an argument about national. They'll just argue use a logical argument. And, there's a lot of logical arguments. And you by logic, you can make anything seem believable. But, if you back it up with evidence, it may or may not be correct. So I usually like to build arguments where I can prove it with, some type of a document. So all of these, and there's a lot more than this. The links to the statutes are large. But when you click on those links, click on one of them, Joe, and you can see what I'm talking about. 87 stat 635. And it'll come up here in a little bit. And I think I provided the links to a government website. Yeah, that is. Oh, no, I posted these pages myself. Yeah. Okay, so on the government website, it wouldn't be highlighted in yellow. But see there, you can see citizen or national. So, at the international level, you hear on TV and the news programs, a national of the United States or a national of Iraq or something like that. That's a term that is used at the international level, and it's gained its credence back in the early 20s. And maybe the United States was the first to use it. I haven't gone that far to into an investigation of it. But, the citizen or national, they're two different things inherently, although an act of Congress could come along and, say that a national includes in the definition section. Oh, a national includes, definitions, statutory definitions, or if an act has a statutory definition, it's real, real important to rely upon it. Don't use your colloquial belief about what a word might mean. But Joe, go back to that page dealing with. Now, Bo, can you enlarge what's down there at the bottom? Well, I don't know whether you can or not, but I've gone through and I quote from regulations, federal regulations and state regulations. Inherently a national means a citizen of the instant possessions. And there's a number of sources I've got cited there where, that's, state regulations, 24 CFR, Section 5.504, but inherently a citizen and a national are two different things. And when somebody comes along and says, I'm a U.S. national, that's going to create a, in the people inside the system, they're going to they know what the national means. They're going to say, wow, this guy is claiming to be a U.S. national, which means the citizens of the insular possessions. And Gary, does, if you're arguing that in the tax context, does that not pose a huge problem for you? Are you not taking a 45 and sticking it in your mouth?
That's a little graphic, but that's true. Well, you know, this national thing, you know, the citizen, resident, nationals, all these theories that have been floating around out there in the movement for years. I mean, this didn't start yesterday, but you know, the definition of a national, as I recall it, is something on the order of, although not a citizen of the United States, a national owes his allegiance to the United States.
Yeah, well, that's the way it got started off. You know, back in the 1800s and the early 1900s, Congress, the way it described a citizen, you know, Uncle Sam only started coming along and getting the insular possessions in the late 1800s. Hey, fought a little war to get to Hawaii, and it remained a territory for a long period of time. But Uncle Sam would refer to those people living over there as people who owed a duty of obedience to the laws of the United States or allegiance to the United States. And that's the way they were described. And so that phrase then got converted to national, you know, in the early 20s.
I don't know what it is why people are afraid to be considered to be, for tax purposes. I mean, let's not go beyond the tax code, but you know, in the chat earlier, the question was posed regarding the citizen of the United States, U.S. person, whatnot. And so, what is the secret? Let me see if I can find the guys. GT. Why would we like the title United States person in the future, if I heard you correctly? That's pretty correct. I'm not going to split a hair, but it's, I mean, I've always said one of these days people are going to find out that they're a United States person and they're going to like it. For example, right. In the FISA law, I mean, you sit there and you watch Brennan testify in front of Congress. You heard Clapper testify, and Brennan was being questioned by Trey Gowdy, and Brennan said, you know, U.S. person.
We can't spy on U.S. citizens, U.S. nationals.
Exactly, can't spy on U.S. persons, and so he mentioned it at least a half a dozen times, and then you know, and Gowdy says, you know. You know the law very well because I sit here and every time you had the opportunity to mention somebody's name, you said U.S. person. And, you know, and that's the most protected, you know, the only way that if we just kind of just open up, you know, the FISA law and read that section dealing with U.S. persons. If a U.S. person comes up trapped in the surveillance, they have to mask, they put like masking tape, you know, visually. But they have to mask the U.S. person's name, privacy. You know, it's a very, very, very proud thing that we should take a step back and say a United States person is held in the highest regard in terms of federal law. They really protect our name, supposedly, but they're supposed to protect our name. Now, as far as, you know, U.S. person and me making that comment about, you know, one of these days you're going to find out that you're a United States person. You're going to like it. You know, digging through the Title Y definitions in 7701A1 is person. Now, that's the very first definition in the Title Y definitions of 7701. So you're sitting there with a definition of person. It says person means and includes an individual. And then they have all these artificial entities, corporation, partnership, trust, estate. But in 7701A1, a person means and includes an individual. Now you go over to 7701A30, which is the definition of a United States person. And it says a United States person means a citizen or resident of the United States. Doesn't say individual. And then, of course, it mentions the corporations, trust, partnerships, and whatnot. But there's that distinction in section 7701A1, person means includes an individual. And you got 7701A30, A30A, citizen or resident of the United States. So when we think in those terms, are you going to be an individual? Well, I can tell you, as a group, you know, if you're an individual who is a citizen, there's a very specific definition with a very specific meaning. And I'm going to tell you, it's for real. If you're an individual, and that's why I say go look at 1.1-1A and compare it to 1.1-1B, because the Secretary of the Treasury, and although the regulation is interpretive as opposed to legislative, you know, the Secretary of the Treasury is saying, you know, the code imposes a tax on the income of every individual who is a citizen or resident of the United States.
In other words, you're agreeing with the Treasury Secretary and the Commissioner of Internal Revenue, what they wrote in the regs interpreting Section 1.
Totally agree. Totally agree.
I'd like to throw in this comment. You know, when the United States Congress got bought the land for the rest of the United States outside the original 13 colonies, those areas, like my area, Alabama, got populated. And we're approaching our 200-year anniversary here in Alabama. But once we got populated, Congress would come along and permit that territory that it was in the past a territory become a new state. And if you take a look at those acts that relate to the admission of a new state into this American Union, all throughout the 19th century, you know, Congress repeatedly sits there and describes the legislative power of the legislative body for either a territory or a newly admitted state. It will extend to all lawful subjects of legislation. And, you know, I think that's a term that people need to start thinking about. You know, the people that were involved in the sovereignty movement, you know, patriots, you know, gee, we come up with these ideas. You know, it's very attractive for people to think in terms of, you know, to have a libertarian frame of mind. Gee, does this particular law apply to me? Well, when you're doing that, you know, you're making an argument that I think needs to be put in terms of a phrase that Congress used. You know, gee, I'm not a lawful subject of legislation for this law. And so the natural question a lot of people ask in reference to the Internal Revenue Code is, gee, you know, I'm not encompassed within this law. I'm not its lawful subject of legislation.
Just taxation without legislation.
Yeah. Yeah, the administrative state, you know.
Yeah, well, they just put the torture equipment over here, and that's where they take you, and it doesn't matter whether there's a law or not, right?
Telling you.
Well, Joe, I've got 9:14 my time here in Central Time Zone. And why don't we take a few more questions?
Okay. So what I did was I tried to grab excerpts from that June 26th chat that I've been promising we would revisit. So you'll see in the chat box, chat excerpt 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yeah. So I tried to at least highlight those. So if you guys want to take chat excerpt 1, it was 7 minutes after the hour. And then I think I pretty much have unbroken to everyone, 2, 3, 4, and 5. But Mark was talking back on the 26th about suggestions, a new version of Save a Patriot. And talked about IRS Zoom, which I've had some interaction with that, or at least seen some of what's been harvested from IRS Zoom. And it seems pretty cool. I mean, I haven't looked all over it, but, and you know, maybe we shouldn't expose all of our little plans, but any guys have any comments on Save a Patriot, what they went through, what where they're at now, whether there's any hope of creating a more improved, more battle-ready. Not to say that John didn't do a great job, but I mean, you know, anything we can learn from the past, any of you guys?
Larry?
I think I probably had a long association with the folks at SAP. First time I met John, I was up in D.C., and he had just gotten out of jail back in about 1984. In 1987, he created Save a Patriot Fellowship. And, you know, I wrote for their submitted articles for their publication. In the 90s, you know, SAP was really growing. I made a lot of trips up to Westminster, had a lot of conferences. And, you know, by the late 90s, you know, SAP was rolling along pretty good. But then what happened is the government used a provision in the tax laws that relates to abusive tax shelters. And they started applying that to Patriot groups. And they started off and, you know, I remember the early 2000s, you know, the government was running around, you know, seeking injunctions against a large number of people in the tax movement. You know, Sean knows about Free Enterprise Society being hit. You know, a lot of groups got hit, and that included SAP. And so once the injunction was entered against SAP, that was something that really hurt them. And then last December when John died, you know, that kind of put the death nail in SAP. You know, now, you know, what goes on up there at Westminster, Gary and I, Tommy created an organization. Gary and Tommy were in Shreveport and created, and I was a part of it, Truth Attack. And now what Gary and I do is on Friday afternoons, we have a radio show up there. It's sponsored by and broadcast by, you know, what's left of SAP. You know, it's the Truth Attack Hour. But they've also got they broadcast radio programs over the internet. And that's basically what SAP is doing right now. There is a need for an organization to come into and step into the shoes of SAP. The thing that I find that's particularly disheartening is that too many people are, you know, like, it's like, I don't know who S Angel is or Angle is, you know, too many people are just like that. Well, just tell me who is not required to file an income tax return. You know, it's a lot bigger than that, but that's what, you know, I was making we had our Tuesday night meeting last night. And we've got our falling off of people that show up for our meetings. And, you know, I'm beginning to attribute it to, you know, the American people are turning into zombies. You know, all they do is a goldfish has an attention span longer than the typical American. And the typical American is sitting there glued to their blooming iPhone. And I kind of think that that's done a great damage to the, you know, it's like some giant machine that came down across America to turn the American people into zombies. And now all they are is these zombies that walk around, you know, they'll walk off a cliff because they're looking at their cell phone. You know, they've now been trained to have an attention span shorter than a goldfish. And, you know, I think that has a substantial bearing upon the patriotism of the American people and their willingness and desire to get involved in something that, you know, to try to change society and into something that favors the people rather than the system.
Anybody heard
of that? That's a lot of work that's required. And there's got to be a lot of interest. You know, you've got to be a patriot. You can't say that I'm a patriot because, you know, I'll listen to and read certain things. You know, huge hordes of American people think like, in a certain way, think conservative. And, you know, they'd like to see something happen. But, you know, a patriot is somebody that moves beyond that, having that mindset into a willingness to, you know, grab the bull by the horns and step into the arena.
I didn't realize that George Harp was
in
this case way back in 96.
Hey, George, what's happened to George? You know, George used to be very active, and George, he just kind of quit doing things.
Yeah, well, Butch Bradley, both, you know, him and George Harp and Tommy and all the good Shreveport boys.
Yeah.
Okay, well, then
you got some LA in you. That's your problem.
Well, you know, that's the least of my problems.
How about chat excerpt 3 from Mark again? Should we address the definition for payor versus payer? Any, Gary on the fly, can you have any comments about that?
Well, payor is the formal treasury decision / Federal Register word. Payer is the Internal Revenue Manual word. I think they're both the same, Mark. I wouldn't try to make an argument that one is different than the other. But payor is the withholding agent or the person making the payment to a payee. And that's that's kind of what it boils down to. It's like, we don't want to get off into the weeds and say, yeah, well, you know, there's an E in there instead of an O, and I would just leave it as payor as the person making the payment to the payee. I hope that, and if there's somebody that has a different definition where they make a distinction saying a payor is, you know, X and a payer is Y, then I'd be open to discuss it and learn more about it. But I've never seen anything in my research that suggests that payor is different than payer.
Well, that's excellent for an extemporaneous reply there. Claire asked, what about aliens who have become naturalized? Would there be any difference between them and a natural born citizen with anything we've been talking about?
Well, I'll describe what a court case back in the 1850s said about the change when, you know, an alien who's becoming naturalized is sitting in a courtroom or, you know, some government office, and he's going to be sworn in as a citizen. You know, this court case said in a footnote, I'd have to dig it out, but it said, you know, at that moment, that's when Congress loses its power over the alien.
Well, that's pretty powerful.
Now, there was a case that was out of the Ninth Circuit back in around the late 80s and early 90s. And the Ninth Circuit made a very curious definition or phraseology referring to a citizen as a resident citizen. A resident U.S. citizen. And scratching around, there's an immigration form. It used to be a form one. It was either a form 179 that they changed the number up and changed it to 197, or it was a 197 and they changed it to 179. They just shuffle the numbers. But what it really, but a resident U.S. citizen is, get your mind on this, because it's going to blow your mind, that is. But a resident U.S. citizen means an alien who becomes a citizen, lives at a border town, and crosses into either Mexico or Canada on frequent intervals to perform services. So a resident U.S. citizen going across a border into Mexico or Canada is a resident U.S. citizen.
Somebody that enters and leaves the United States at frequent intervals.
There you go. High five, Larry.
Very good. Well, that's some, again, extemporaneously, you guys are just hitting it out of the park. All right, so let's continue here. Chat excerpt number 5. Use of the phrase, all income from whatever source derived, as mentioned in the definition of gross income, is all inclusive to whatever is not mentioned in items of income. In other words, wages and salaries that are not mentioned in section 61 would be construed to be implied, though not specifically mentioned. Still stuck on the vagueness of the gross income definition, which uses the phrase, quote, all income from whatever source derived, unquote.
How many sources are there?
We talked about that last week, right?
Yeah.
Two?
Just two.
Well, Joe, I was looking, is that a question left over from June 26th or is it on today's?
No, that's June 26th, just trying to fulfill that obligation. So it's in chat excerpt number 5 at 10 after the.
I'd like to make some comments about that.
Go right ahead.
Okay. Between, you know, you can go all the way back in the 1894 Act, 1913 Act, but certainly from 1916 forward, all the way up through August of 1954, when the 1939 code was replaced by the 54 code. But all during that period of time, gross income was defined as, or the statutory definition of gross income, or the scope, you know, what the tax was going to be imposed upon, was encompassed within these words. It's the gains, profits, and income derived from wages, salaries, and compensation for personal services. You know, I like to call that because that's the phrase used in gross income and the gross income sections of the 28 the 39 code. That was section 22. And so I like to call that the section 22 definition of gross income that was being taxed. But then, you know, that section 22 under the 39 code was replaced in 1954 with section 61. And when you start off with section 61, wages and salaries are not in section 61 of the current code, which also defines gross income. But here's what I think is real important. You know, the meaning of gross income, you know, appearing in all these tax acts, stretching back to 1894, you know, has been before the United States Supreme Court a number of times. And the Supreme Court of the United States has said in a number of cases that the section 22 definition of gross income expresses the maximum reach of Congress's power to tax pursuant to the 16th Amendment. Now, section 20, Congress says that section 22 of the 39 code equals section 61 of the Internal Revenue Code. And then also the United States Supreme Court has also said in reference to section 61, that it also expresses in words the maximum reach of Congress's power to tax incomes under the 16th Amendment. So both section 61 and section 22 of the 39 code express, those are real good expressions of the maximum reach of Congress's power to tax incomes. So then let's use, since section 61 and section 22 are equal, and let's examine section 22. Gains, profits, and income, that's the subject of the tax. But then if you use rules of statutory construction, you know, the most notable an obvious rule of statutory construction to use in this particular example is this particular rule, that every word, you can't have a word in an act that means the same thing as another word or has no meaning at all. Each word is used by Congress for its own express purposes, and each word has a different meaning. So then, you know, it gains profits and income, then pursuant to this rule of statutory construction, is something entirely different from wages, salaries, and compensation for services. But then wages are not the same thing as salaries, and salaries are not the same thing as compensation for services, and compensation for services is not the same thing as wages and salaries. So they're all different. But then income is derived from something separate and apart from wages, salaries, and compensation for services. Most people think of wages as being, you know, payment for work done on an hourly basis. And you could work for a corporation for a long period of time just working for wages. Salaries, what do salaries mean? Salaries means, you know, payment, not according to the hour, but by a different period of time, like a week, a month, or a year. But then compensation for services is something entirely different. And most people are going to sit there and take a look today, you know, they're befuddled. Wow, you know, suddenly wages and salaries are not mentioned in the gross income section. You know, it starts off with compensation for services, and everybody gives compensation for services its ordinary everyday meaning. Now, Gary, you and I know that words in the tax laws, well, most people think of them as words, and therefore they attribute to those words their ordinary everyday meaning. But we look at things different. No, these are terms. Right. And these terms have their own special meaning. So I think, you know, that if you go back into, you know, the cases that have addressed this issue of, you know, are wages income or are they not income? Parties make arguments, are wages are not income. You know, people went ill-prepared to court and created a disaster with that issue.
Sure have.
You know, you're just hearing in tonight's discussion, I pointed out that there's a great distinction between wages and income. And, you know, the only way you can learn a little something about this, you know, to me, it's real important to know something about the history of the tax laws. And that's something that people need to dig into. You know, I would like for people to take on a routine basis every week, just sit down and pull out get a legal pad or, you know, a notebook or something like that. And every week say, I'm going to devote an hour to look at this stuff. Just an hour. Well, at the end of a year, you would have 52 hours of stuff done.
That's probably more than most CPAs.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot that can be learned in that short period of time. And a lot of, and I would suggest the only place you need to go over is my website, the taxation page. And
that's a fact.
You can find all the old tax regulations and all the regulations. You can download them. And lo and behold, they're word searchable.
You know, one other thing about that statement that was read there, where he says Section 61 would be construed by to be implied. You know, it's there is no such thing as taxation by implication. Supreme Court said that over and over and over again. These right. tax acts have to be specific as a hair on your head. So you can't imply something that is not in the statute either.
Right. Good point.
Excellent. I didn't know what my speaker was on.
Well, Larry, you mentioned compensation for services. Would that be something like on the compensation would be like vacation pay or sick pay or something like that?
I turn my mic back on. This is what I'm going to answer that question, Gary, in a very oblique way. I'm going to challenge the people who are participating in this conference call tonight, this Zoom meeting. You can go over to my website, that taxation page. You can download all the old regulations. There's regulations 45, regulations 62, all the way up to regulations 103 for the 39 code. Download them all. And then since they're all word searchable, find in those regulations where there are basically definitions of compensation for services. And when you read that definition of compensation, now that I've got my, let me pull it up, Joe. Now that I've got my Explorer open.
Well, do you want to tell me where it's at and I'll find it quick?
Well.
Go to taxation.
Yeah, but I've got it in, you know, you'll have to pull down the whole old tax regulations, and I've got them already in single page, so it's going to be easier and quicker for me to do it. So let me, okay, I'm at that spot.
So you want the screen?
No. Well, hey, Joe, why don't I email this to you?
Okay.
And let me get out of all this. Open up Thunderbird.
I want to thank everybody for hanging around.
Yeah,
we go pretty long, don't we?
Yeah, Larry wanted to turn the lights out, and now he wants me to.
Well, what are we going to do? Make an assignment on this search thing. It's not a bad idea for the participating audience. We can ask the first question next week after we've done the presentation and ask the audience, okay, you tell us what's compensation for services. Because if you go through this and you go through what Larry's offering you, you'll find it.
Yeah, while we're waiting for Larry to email me that, maybe you guys, any other chats that came from tonight's show that either of you guys saw that you could want to make a comment on?
Okay, Joe, it's coming to you. I didn't put a subject line in. It's just a raw attachment to an email. It says Regs 45 compensation.
Well, Cassandra got it right. within the United States and without the United States are your sources of income.
Okay, Joe, did you get it?
Yep, opening it up now.
You know, if you look at the tax laws and give the ordinary everyday meaning to words, and that's incorrect, and their terms, and they're far more limited, then, you know, just the giving the ordinary definition to words, in essence, what you're doing is you're construing the tax laws far broader than they really are. Oh, gee, I don't know why that comes up the way that it does, Joe.
Well, isn't that the intent of Congress, Larry?
Well, these are regulations, you know.
Define the tax laws as broadly as possible. Isn't that what government wants you to do?
Well, there's a lot of that at work, but then also there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of desire to keep it constitutional and be very specific and precise.
Yeah.
But then a lot of the fault comes about because too many people, you know, including tax professionals,
mm-hmm.
you know, but
start with the IRS.
Yeah. I don't know what's causing this problem here with the extra words that appear on the screen here in reference to Article 32. The Regs 45 were the regulations adopted by the Secretary of the Treasury and Commissioner of Internal Revenue to implement the Revenue Act of 1918, which was passed in 1919. You know, here you had, let's say that there were 10,000 people that were working for the Bureau of Internal Revenue back in those days. Well, you know, everybody, you couldn't have just one agent in the field just coming up with his own willy-nilly belief about what the law meant. You know, there had to be, you know, what regulations were primarily to begin with was, this is the agency's statement that everybody's going to stick with what it means. This is the way it operates. And that's the purpose of these regulations. So you have regulations 45, 62, 74, you know, all the way up to 101 and 103. They're all posted over my website. Those are regulations adopted for all these tax acts that happened between 1918 and 1939. And you can download them. They were all word searchable. But the point I want to make is the first time, you know, here in the Revenue Act of 1918, you know, you had this section 210 dealing with definition of gross income. Gross income means gains, profits, and income derived from wages, salaries, and compensation for personal services. That's a part of the quote. Well, then the commissioner's got to find, you know, he's got to have a uniform interpretation for the whole agency. Well, what does compensation for personal services mean? And to me, there's a lot of meaning in the first phrase of the first sentence in Article 32.
I found it off your website, Larry.
Ah, okay, that's a lot better. Yeah, that's a lot better. Yeah. I don't know what's causing that to show up the way it does on your screen from what I emailed to you. But see down here, Article 32, where no determination of compensation is had until the completion of the services. That's something that's real important because, you know, there was no, the party that is receiving compensation for services, in essence, had no contract with the party he's giving the services to. And, you know, later on, you can see, you know, like a pastor saying sums paid for saying masses for the dead or marriage fees or baptismal offerings, and, you know, gifts and contributions received by clergymen. Hey, those, you know, a pastor, you know, you go to these funerals and pastors are saying, you know, conducting a service there for the dearly departed, you know, that he's just doing that on his own, but people will pay him. There's no contract. He doesn't have a claim for it. He can't sue somebody. You didn't pay me. Well, something's given, and it's given for, you know, hey, this guy did something for me. And, you know, that's the nature of what compensation for personal services is. Now, you can follow this. You know, the reason why the knowing, you know, you can take Article 20, you can take Section 22 of the code, or it'll be Section 210 in the earlier stuff, then become 22 and then become Section 61. But, you know, you can find, you know, you can see, and I've got it posted over my website, all these statutory definitions of gross income. It's over one page of my website. But then you can, you know, find in the regulations, since these regulations are word searchable, you can find, you know, this compensation for personal services. You can follow it all the way up through, you know, what it was saying and for the 1939 Internal Revenue Code, Regs 103, all the way up to Regs 118. And, you know, simply following it forward and looking at the words, you know, there's a lot of meaning there. You know, the pensions and pensions and retired pay for people that work for the government, if that isn't income, I don't know what is. Retirement benefits of government employees of the federal government, boy, that is pure unmitigated income. And part of the reason is Congress can't make an appropriation for more than 2 years. Well, there's usually never any budgeting act for Congress in 1 year, basically. But, you know, nobody has a claim on the federal government beyond what is currently appropriated. And so when you have federal employees, they can never have a contract with Uncle Sam. For, you know, what's being paid to them is acknowledgement of a political benefit, so to speak. But they can't make a contract for longer than 1 year for retirement benefits. It's all gratuity, and boy, you know, they're not working, and they're getting because they worked in the past. Uncle Sam comes along and says, "Oh, we're going to give you something now." If that isn't pure profit from employment, I don't know what is. Hmm. And boy, that's the inherent quality of income.
All right. So we do talk about this quite frequently, but over here on Larry's website, which I have illustrated, you can just find all kinds of goodies, and he's got all the hyperlinks here. And that's where I went to you know, look at that reg that talked about compensation for services. So it's all right here. Just go to the old tax acts and regulations part of Larry's website. When you land on the website, you'll see a Dixieland Law Journal, and then you go to the taxation section, and you can study to your heart's content. So we've gone on quite a long time here, so I just wanted to point out very quickly, I had on the screen just briefly, just the hosts. So Larry, you can go to startpage.com, type in BCraft Briefs or Dixieland Law Journal and see all of that great stuff he's got on his website. SeanO'Connor.org or FreeEnterpriseSocietyServices.org if you're a quick typer. And you can check out Sean's website. Gary, you can just email him directly, gary@npn.net. And I'm at agentfortruth.com. We invite you to check out the websites. And we enjoy this very much. So hope you do too. We kept a we had like 25 people that hung on to the end. And I think we had over 30, which might be close to not including us hosts, might be close to a record. So we'll just send it around the table. Gary, any last words to the audience?
I just want to thank everybody for coming every Wednesday and hanging around with us. And any questions you have, feel free to email me. And if I can't answer it, I'm going to shuffle it around and we'll get consensus on it.
All right, Sean.
But well, thank you all for tuning in, for sure.
Yep, I'd like to thank everybody for tuning in. And the audience is growing, folks. It's because of you. You're inviting more people. You're telling the people you've got to watch the show at least once. So thank you all for getting more people on here and getting them educated. This is what we need to turn this around.
Absolutely. Now, it's almost Larry's bedtime there in Huntsville. So we're going to sign off. Larry, any last words or just a good night?
No, I'm ready to go watch the news, Joe, but I want our friends to come back every week. I won't be here next week, but, you know, this group, I've known this group for decades, and our intention is to try to wake people up and teach them something valuable. That's what our intention is.
There is. Fantastic. All right. Well, yeah, I can see people have been spreading the word. We have more in the audience than we have in the past.
And thank you, Cassandra.
Yeah.
Appreciate the thumbs up.
We appreciate y'all very much. All right. Well, then we are going to sign off and we'll see y'all. One more thing quickly. The agentfortruth.com, the radio show menu item. I've posted quite a few of the archive shows, not all of them, but I'm nearly up to date. So feel free to go there and point other people there. Maybe people who haven't been able to join in the past, but would have liked to. There's tons of archive shows there at agentfortruth.com, radio show menu item, and point people there, and then maybe they will join us live in the future. So God bless everybody. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.